Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. Today, we're going to have some stories of flood survivors, some very harrowing ordeals that they've gone through. We'll update you on relief efforts and also what you can do to help flood survivors in the San Diego region. We'll also have some tips from the county for you on mold remediation if you suffered flood damage, and where you can get sandbags at fire stations across the county because a new storm is coming in next week. We also have an updated story on the financial situation of the Water Conservation Garden. Friends of the Water Conservation Garden have asked the Joint Powers Authority for funding to get them out of a financial crisis, but so far, the JPA members are balking. We've also got a warning for you about how to avoid scammers preying on flood victims. Then, from Public News Service, we'll have some national news stories today, including the latest on the child care tax credit and the Israel-Gaza war. Then on Bookshelf, we'll be having a rerun with one of our favorite episodes today, our interview with Diane Lindsay about her book, Costa Cactus, telling you about all those great trails you can go hiking on across the San Diego region. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters. Thousands of flood survivors sought help at the local assistance center in the Spring Valley Library opened by the county from January 28th through 31st. Among them was 86-year-old Bienvenida Ford. She felt the water on her feet as floodwaters entered her home on January 22nd, but all she could do was yell for her sleeping daughter, Debbie, who jumped up and called 911. But by then, the waters rushing in from the swollen Choyas Creek were already up to the women's calves, and within 20 minutes, the water in their National Avenue living room was up to Bienvenida's ribs. Just in the nick of time, two rescue workers swam inside and dragged Bienvenida out by her armpits to higher ground. Meanwhile, Debbie Ford, her adult daughter, was fending for herself, half paddling, half floating out the front door and toward higher ground. Hundreds of yards away, she could see their freezer, recently stuffed with homemade lumpia, laying on its side on a neighbor's property. Bienvenida told East County Magazine, "I felt like a knife had been stuck in my chest. I wanted to cry, but I could not." She recalled the decades of photographs and other treasured items that had been swept away in the flood. At the Spring Valley Center, a slew of local and state agencies set up tables to provide a range of services to flood survivors, including document replacement, health services, food assistance, debit cards, pet supplies, and mental health support. A volunteer at the check-in desk said that over 5,000 people had checked in to seek assistance of some sort as of the last day that the center was open. San Diego County and the state of California have declared emergencies. The county has been gathering damage reports in hopes of qualifying for federal FEMA funds to aid victims of this disaster. But so far, a federal disaster declaration has not yet been issued. Representatives from state agencies set up tables at the site, but they had few answers and referred most questions to different telephone numbers in Sacramento. In the center, everyone was scrambling to line up for some form of help while the next set of storms was brewing. In the parking lot, tents with additional assistance were set up, including the San Diego Food Bank handing out food. While people stood in lines to speak to representatives from SDG&E, the DMV, the Department of Insurance, and more, others, like the Fords, took the moment to relay their terrifying ordeal to volunteers. As tears slid down Debbie Ford's face, a volunteer from Tzu Chi, a Buddhist social services agency, demonstrated how to make the symbol of a heart with her fist. And then everyone at the table raised their fists in an act of solidarity with the Fords. Tzu Chi also gave out debit cards to help the Fords buy basic necessities. The Fords relayed how everything accumulated in their 30 years in their home was destroyed, an antique grandfather clock, precious letters, and other relics from a life spanning 86 years in their journey from the Philippines to San Diego. Debbie Ford said, "My mom has already been through too much. Bienvenida was orphaned at age 5 by the war between Japan and the Philippines, bearing 9 children and burying 2 of them." Debbie said her mother asked after the flood, Why couldn't this wait until I die? A GoFundMe page has been set up to help Bienvenida. It's titled, Help Our Grandma Rebuild Her Life. That's at GoFundMe.org. Another flood survivor at the local assistance center was Hannah, who declined to give her last name. She was waiting to get a copy of her infant son's birth certificate. It had been destroyed, along with everything else, inside the 69th Street apartment their family had lived in for the last 6 years. Outside, a neighbor's fence fell on their car and destroyed the vehicle. The family walked away from the scene up a hill with only their lives. Unsure where they would sleep after visiting the center, Hannah's eyes told the story of a woman carrying the weight of the world on her shoulders. Hannah, like the Fords and so many others, rented her home. They didn't have renter's insurance. But renter's insurance has failed to cover flood damages even for those with policies, since normal insurance policies exclude flooding from natural disasters, so special flood insurance is needed. Donna Schwisberg, a volunteer from National Crisis Response Canines, walked her 10-year-old golden retriever, Bentley, looking for people who would get some comfort from the cuddly dog. She said of the therapy dogs present, "They can tell when people need a little warmth." As another series of atmospheric rivers gathered energy outside, for the flood victims who had been displaced, there was only one key question. Where do we go? The county has closed a temporary shelter at Lincoln High School, but has now opened a new shelter in the municipal gymnasium in Balboa Park. People staying at the shelter have been fed with food donated by area restaurants and provided showers at the Jackie Robinson YMCA. Gift cards donated to the YMCA have been used to buy residents' clothing. Here are some ways that you can help. You can donate to the San Diego Foundation's Flood Relief Fund set up with the county. This fund is providing money to nonprofit organizations aiding flood victims. Or donate to the shelter. Donations are being collected at the Jackie Robinson YMCA, and there was a demand for clothing in all sizes as well as toiletries. Gift cards are preferred over used clothing. Volunteers to staff phone lines for the San Diego Chapter of Voluntary Organizations Active in a Disaster, or VOAD, are also needed. And you can check that out at VOAD's website. You can also give on GoFundMe, where many flood survivors have set up fundraising pages to help them rebuild their lives. Just put in the search term San Diego Flood on GoFundMe.com. The House of Ukraine has also set up an emergency fund to help the Ukrainian church in Spring Valley, which suffered over $300,000 in damage from the flood, including direct damages to the church, as well as destruction of many humanitarian supplies slated to be sent to war-torn Ukraine. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
More than 350 people in East County have been displaced from their homes by flood damage, and even more in the city of San Diego. Besides water damage, now residents cleaning up damaged homes face the threat of mold. The longer materials stay wet, the more likely mold will grow. It takes only 2 to 3 days for mold to form. Mold can pose health problems, especially for young children, seniors, and those who are already ill. Long-term exposure can affect anyone. To take care of it, flood-impacted residents can hire a licensed mold remediation contractor with special training and equipment, or they can work to get rid of the mold themselves. Some volunteer groups are also helping residents with cleanup efforts. Take pictures of the damage for insurance purposes before cleanup begins. If you plan to handle the job yourself, here are some tips to keep in mind. Wear protective gear such as gloves, goggles, and a respirator rated N95 or higher. Seal off moldy areas from the rest of the house and keep it well ventilated. Put moldy porous materials like flooded carpeting, upholstery, and mattresses into plastic bags and throw them away. Remove wet insulation even if the wallboard appears dry. Cut the wall covering above the water line because moisture can seep up. Clean and disinfect non-porous materials such as hard plastic, concrete, glass, metal, and solid wood with non-phosphate all-purpose cleaners. Cleaning alone will remove the mold, but not kill it. Dead spores can still be a problem, so disinfect after cleaning. To make disinfectant, mix 1 cup of household bleach with 1 gallon of water. Never mix bleach with ammonia, which creates a hazardous combination. After cleaning and disinfecting, air out the building. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
Another storm may hit our region next week, so the county and CAL FIRE are offering free sandbags to residents and businesses in the unincorporated areas to prepare for heavy rain. The January 22nd storm brought historic rainfall to the county, causing flood damage to many homes and businesses. So to be prepared for potential flooding or soil erosion, people in the unincorporated areas can visit fire stations to get and fill sandbags. Be sure to call ahead to check availability, since some stations have only bags and no sand, and others have both sand and bag, and supplies are limited. Residents are also encouraged to visit alertsandiego.org for information on what to do during an emergency, tips on how to prepare for a disaster, and find resources about recovery efforts.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from San Diego's East County.
Friends of the Water Conservation Garden and the garden's new interim director, Lauren Magnuson, made impassioned pleas at a January 23rd meeting asking the Joint Powers Authority, or JPA, to allocate additional funds through June to help alleviate a financial crisis. The garden is celebrating the 25th anniversary this year, Magnuson said. We supported the community during the pandemic. Now we are hoping that the community will support us. The garden has over $1 million in financial obligations, including large loans taken out during the pandemic and some smaller grant funds slated to be returned. Questions have been raised by the JPA over the years of inaccurate record-keeping practices and borrowing by the Friends organization to cover the garden's operating expenses. The garden has cut its monthly budget by more than half, furloughed many workers, and asked others to take a 20% pay cut, according to Magnuson, who has pledged full transparency as she strives to find options to help the garden survive and grow, a task that is currently daunting. The JPA, which has oversight authority over the garden, consists of members from several water districts, as well as the County Water Authority, the City of San Diego, and the Grossmont-Cuyamaca Community College District. Dr. Michael Hager, president of the Friends Board, told the JPA that the garden has taken significant steps to tackle the financial crisis, which he says arose from impacts of the pandemic and insufficient funding. Before COVID, the JPA had an agreement with Friends to slash the JPA's annual funding, which was $487,000 5 years ago, but just $320,000 this year. Hager told the JPA, "We are seeking assistance from the JPA to continue to serve the community to learn about water conservation." Magnuson indicated that without additional funds, the garden will run out of money in a couple of months. Hager says the garden is suffering the effects of long COVID. Since during the pandemic, the garden remained open, membership rose, and yoga classes were added to help people stay active outdoors and bring revenues in. But large events had to be canceled due to the COVID lockdowns, and donations also fell. So the Friends group took out a Small Business Administration loan of $509,000 for 30 years at a 1.2% interest rate. They also applied for a Federal Employee Retention Credit, or ERC, of nearly $250,000. But the IRS later placed all ERC funds on a moratorium. So 2 years later, the garden has not received those funds. According to Friends, the IRS has again begun processing applications in the pipeline, but nobody knows when those funds will arrive. To stay eligible for those funds, the garden had to retain employees, which meant paying out hefty salaries. Using the federal letter promising the ERC funds, Friends got mission-driven finance to issue a $190,000 loan at 8% interest that was due December 31st, 2023. They are now in default on this loan, though Hager says the mission-driven finance has negotiated with them to extend payments. Friends also took out a $200,000 loan from the college district that will be due May 31st, but Friends lacks the money to repay that. In addition, the Garden must repay $10,000 in grant funds from the American Water Charitable Foundation for a tree program that has been discontinued due to lack of staffing, and must pay the county back over $40,000 for unspent capital expenses through the Neighborhood Reinvestment Program grant. Friends representatives have delayed signing a California Museum grant for an Oak Grove project, including Native American interpretive exhibits, due to a requirement to retain employees that it may not be able to afford. The Garden also owes $55,000 to the San Diego Housing Commission, which prepaid the Garden for projects that were completed, but missing receipts and inaccessible bank statements resulted in Friends being unable to document how funds were being spent. Additionally, an artist is still owed $10,000 for illustrating a book by Pam Meisner, better known as Miss Smarty Plants, after grant funds were put into a general fund and mistakenly spent on other projects, Meisner told the JPA board. JPA board members greeted those revelations with frustration. Chairman Bark Roback asked, "What kind of oversight was there by the Friends Board of what was going on here?" JPA member from Helix Water District said, "If you're borrowing all this money hoping to pay it back, counting on government subsidies, then you're in trouble." A letter from Optima, the accounting firm that has worked with the Garden since 2021, concluded that it found no evidence of intentional fraud or wrongdoing, but did find lax oversight and lack of understanding of proper accounting procedures. Optima detailed troubling findings predating the current leadership, including 990 tax forms from 2019, before COVID, which showed administrative expenses at 59% and program expenses at 36%, a challenge for bringing in donations. There were also insecure financial practices, such as leaving daily deposit envelopes with cash in a small carrier safe with a key that all Garden employees could access. At a December meeting, Friends presented the JPA with a survive and thrive plan that included a bare-bones budget while working to get the Garden back on stable financial ground. At the January 23rd JPA meeting, Friends presented the JPA with five options. Boost the JPA's monthly support by $65,000 a month for 5 months, a total of $325,000. Dismiss the Friends board and have the JPA operate the Garden. Contract with the college to manage the Garden located at the campus of Cuyamaca College. Have the JPA advance a consolidation loan at a low rate, or shut down the Garden until June, cancel all educational programs, events, and admissions until a new agreement is created. None of the JPA board members spoke in favor of giving the Friends organization the supplemental funding requested, and some voiced opposition. Nicole Bolio DeSantis, with the City of San Diego, observed that the $65,000 a month requested broke down to about $11,000 for each of the JPA member agencies. JPA member Dan McMillan from the County Water Authority noted that even if they were to go back to their member agencies with such a request, it could take 2 months for it to be approved. Chancellor Lynn Nolt said repayment by June was a condition of the college district's $200,000 interest-free loan. She did not comment on whether or not the college district might be willing to take over management of the Garden. The chancellor also told Magnuson, "I commend you for your honesty and transparency," drawing applause. She added, "We just want the Garden to succeed." Several people offered public comments and some urged that the JPA take action to assure preservation of the garden. Stephen Zolezzi, president of the garden's approximately 100 volunteers, urged the JPA to lean on us, noting that many volunteers have expertise. He said the volunteers support keeping the garden beautiful moving forward. Rosalie Dosick, a 20-year volunteer, announced, "This garden is now a museum." She discussed plans to reopen the gift shop as a museum gift store with more upscale items. Pam Meisner urged the board not to blame the current board for mistakes made in the past. "I think it would be very sad if we dropped the education program," she stated. Kathleen Brand, a landscape architect and member of the Friends board, called the garden an important asset to the whole county, adding, "I hope that you do support the garden in the future." Friends of the Water Conservation Garden is planning a crowdsourcing campaign while continuing to apply for grants. For now, you can help by making donations at thegarden.org. You can also host events such as weddings or parties at the garden's venues, or purchase a membership which includes reciprocal admission to some 300 other gardens across the U.S. In addition, you can also attend the garden's upcoming Tomato Mania event, March 8th and 9th, billed as the world's largest tomato seedling sale. The JPA did not make a decision on the future of the garden. The JPA board will be discussing options at a closed session meeting at a date to be determined. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
Now it's time for East County Magazine's Scammers, Schemers, and Swindlers Report, shining a light on shady deals all around us. San Diego County District Attorney Summer Steffen is warning businesses and scammers not to take advantage of consumers by price gouging or other fraud schemes during this state of emergency, since doing so can result in prosecution and jail. As a result of the devastation caused by the severe storm January 22nd, the county has proclaimed a local emergency. The city of San Diego also proclaimed an emergency, and Governor Gavin Newsom has declared one in the county. Now, during a declared state of emergency, it's illegal for a business to increase its prices for essential goods or services by more than 10% unless they can show their own costs have been increased. Steffen says, "The recovery process for people suffering from disasters, including their homes and businesses getting flooded, can be very difficult. We want to send a clear message that we will not tolerate any unlawful activity by greedy businesses, contractors, or scammers who would seek to financially exploit victims of a disaster. Violations of the price gouging statute are subject to criminal prosecution, which can result in 1 year imprisonment in county jail and or a fine of up to $10,000. Violations are also subject to civil enforcement actions, including penalties of up to $2,500 per violation, injunctive relief, and victim restitution. Now, the price gouging prohibition applies to several products and necessities, including food and drink, pet supplies, livestock feed, emergency supplies such as water, flashlights, radios, batteries, candles, blankets, soap, diapers, toiletries, and building materials, medical supplies such as prescription as well as non-prescription medications, bandages, gauze, isopropyl alcohol, and antibacterial products. It's also a misdemeanor for a hotel or motel to increase regular rates by more than 10% during a declared emergency and for 30 days afterwards. Consumers should be extremely cautious if approached by aggressive agents, adjusters, or contractors after a disaster. Most businesses are honest and have good intentions, but there are always bad actors waiting to take advantage of disaster victims. Working as an unlicensed contractor during a state of emergency is a felony, so keep these tips in mind when selecting a contractor. Ask for proof of licensing, such as a pocket license and second photo ID. Always verify that the license number matches the contractor you're dealing with. Beware of scare tactics, odd calls, or unsolicited contacts. Be sure the contractor carries workers' compensation and liability insurance. After natural disasters, debris clearing scams often surface. Don't provide payment up front and be sure to ask where the debris is being taken. Scammers often ask for money up front and then they disappear. Sometimes they dump that debris on a neighbor's property or park, which may cause you to be responsible for their costs and penalties. The public is also warned to be cautious when dealing with people soliciting for purported victim relief charities. Many legitimate organizations seek contributions during or after an emergency, but scammers often use phony charitable pleas in times like these. Potential contributors should insist on seeing proper credentials before offering to help. Here's where you can find resources. You can file a price gouging complaint with the San Diego District Attorney or the California Attorney General's Office. You can get insurance help at the California Department of Insurance and check a contractor license or file a complaint with the contractor's state licensing board.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for San Diego's inland region. Now, stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast, February the 2nd, 2024. I'm Mike Clifford. Tax filing season is underway, and Congress is a step closer to helping low-income families get a bigger break on their returns. Policy experts say a new expansion of the child tax credit would address poverty. We get this perspective from Wisconsin.
Late this week, the U.S. House passed a bipartisan tax bill that includes a three-year expansion of the child tax credit. Analysts say it isn't as robust as the one-year expansion from 2021, but a key provision would allow families with little or no income to gain eligibility. Tim Smeeting, a retired economist with the University of Wisconsin, says it could allow struggling households to address a big expense they haven't been able to cover.
You can pay heating bills that you've let go because you know that the utility won't shut you off until you get the tax refund.
He says eliminating those debts frees up money for families to spend on children's needs. Unlike the previous expansion, there would not be monthly payments. It would only apply to a family's income tax refund. The compromise measure also includes business tax breaks. Despite bipartisan support in the House, the bill faces an uncertain future in the Senate, with pushback from both Republicans and Democrats. I'm Mike Moen.
Bill sponsors hope to get final approval so qualifying households could claim the credit on this year's taxes. President Biden Thursday signed an executive order allowing the U.S. to impose new sanctions on Israeli settlers and potentially Israeli politicians and government officials involved in violent attacks against Palestinians. That from Axios. They report the unprecedented executive order is the most significant step that any U.S. administration has ever taken in response to violence against Palestinian civilians in the West Bank. Axios adds there have been nearly 500 Israeli settler attacks against Palestinians since October the 7th. Next from our Danielle Smith, a new report sheds light on who would benefit most in Pennsylvania from raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour by the year 2026.
More than 1.3 million workers would see higher paychecks, says report author Claire Kovach with the Keystone Research Center. Pennsylvania's minimum wage has been $7.25 per hour for more than a decade, and the state has lost significant buying power in that time. Kovach says the data analyzes the potential impact of a higher minimum wage based on demographics like age, race, education, gender, and industry.
Women disproportionately benefit from $15 per hour minimum wage. This is because women are disproportionately working low-wage jobs, especially low-wage service jobs.
Kovach says one in four workers who would see higher paychecks are in crucial sectors like education, healthcare, hospitality, and social work.
This is Public News Service. Next, we head to Connecticut, where they are considering ending legacy admissions at all public and private colleges. That's the practice of giving preference to family members of alumni.
The proposal comes after the Supreme Court's 2023 decision ending affirmative action. Yale University has seen legacy admissions decline, with legacy students making up just 11% of the class of 2027. Schools opposed to ending legacy admissions say it'll disrupt their autonomy in the admissions process and could harm fundraising efforts. Amy Dowell with Education Reform Now CT says transparency in admissions is what's needed most.
You know, I think that what we need is a greater level of transparency in terms of who's considered a viable candidate at some of these colleges.
Similar legislation was considered in 2022, and it was met with the same kinds of opposition the new proposal is getting. This isn't new territory, however. Colorado banned legacy admissions at its public universities in 2021. A Virginia bill similar to Colorado's recently passed that state's General Assembly and awaits the governor's signature. I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
One study finds between 2014 and 2019, Harvard University accepted legacy students at a 33% rate. That's five times higher than its overall acceptance rate. And as people in Georgia mobilize for the 2024 general election, one group wants to make it easier for those with felony records to understand their voting rights and get them reinstated if that's needed.
The Campaign Legal Center's Restore Your Vote campaign includes an online Restore Your Vote tool. It's estimated about 275,000 Georgia residents have been disenfranchised because of felony convictions. However, Blair Bowie with the Campaign Legal Center says voting laws are complex and different from state to state, and many people don't know they could restore their voting rights.
So in Georgia and North Carolina, restoration of voting rights is automatic once a person has finished probation and parole. So at that point, they can just go ahead and register to vote.
Nationally, it's estimated that up to 18 million people with felony records still have the right to vote. Shantia Hudson reporting.
Finally, our Suzanne Potter reminds us today is National Wear Red Day, part of American Heart Month in February.
Lots of celebrities and news anchors will be wearing red, and many iconic buildings and bridges will be lit up in crimson, all part of a partnership with the American Heart Association. Heart Month events draw attention to deaths from cardiovascular disease, which have been rising since the COVID pandemic. Linda Tsai with the American Heart Association says cardiovascular disease took 900,000 American lives last year, 57,000 more than in 2021.
We just did a recent survey that shows that more than half of the people in the U.S. don't know that heart disease is their number one cause of death.
This is Mike Clifford, and thank you for ending your week with Public News Service, member and listener supported. Hear us on interesting radio stations, your favorite podcast platform, and you can find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
If you would like to help local victims recover from the recent severe storm damage, you can now make a financial donation to a new flood response fund. The county worked with the San Diego Foundation to set up the online fund at sandiegofoundation.org. The San Diego Foundation will match donations up to $100,000. So far, more than $500,000 has been raised through this fund. Money from the fund will only be directed to nonprofits helping flood victims. So far, the San Diego Foundation has allocated $120,000 in flood relief funds to these nonprofits. Jackie Robinson YMCA, to provide access to showers, hot meals, counselors, and other essential support to survivors of San Diego's historic flood. San Diego County Black Chamber of Commerce, to provide grants to small family-owned restaurants that have and will continue to provide hot meals to survivors of San Diego's historic floods. Harvey Family Foundation, to support flood survivors, including debris and furniture removal, cleaning supplies for homeowners and volunteers, hot meals for homeowners and volunteers, trash removal, and more. YMCA of San Diego County, to provide gift cards directly to families in need to purchase essential items. Sharia's Closet, to provide clothing, shoes, and other essentials to survivors. San Diego Hip Hop Health and Wellness, to assist with temporary housing vouchers for displaced residents. The January 22nd storm was the fourth wettest day recorded since 1850. The torrential downpours caused millions of dollars of damage, flooded streets and roadways, damaged hundreds of homes, and created mudslides, erosion, and more. Crews are still assessing the damage. San Diego County is asking for the public's help in reporting the damage through a voluntary online survey at the county's website. Once enough damage is reported the county could be eligible for residents who suffered damage to receive federal FEMA funds. Before attempting to clean up after the storm, visit the recovery page at alertsandiego.org for tips on documenting damage and filing claims. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
The city of El Cajon is going to the dogs. Literally, the city is trying to break the world record for the most dogs to watch a movie screening together. The current record of 219 dogs was set last September. Organizers in El Cajon will attempt to break that record with a showing of Beethoven, a family comedy film that features a St. Bernard dog who causes all kinds of trouble for his human family. The event is scheduled to take place at Wells Park on East Madison Avenue in El Cajon on Saturday, February 24th at 1 p.m. That's right, you don't have to get up early to join this canine crowd. It is important to make sure that all dogs are vaccinated and not aggressive because no one wants any fights or fleas at this event. There will also be plenty of fun activities for kids at this fun event that is one for the record books. Wells Park has dog parks for dogs large and small, as well as a canine agility course. So you may want to arrive early to let your dog enjoy some off-leash time before showtime. Whether or not the event breaks any records, organizers want it to be a fun, safe, and enjoyable day for everyone involved, especially for all those furry friends. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Diana Lindsay. My guest is president of Sunbelt Publications and leading editor of the book Coast to Cactus, The Canyoneer Trail Guide to San Diego Outdoors. Coast to Cactus, which was published by Sunbelt in partnership with the San Diego Natural History Museum, contains 245 outings and 73 extension hikes. Welcome, Diana. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Let's start with the book. I know that it's based on the weekly Romo-Rama column for the San Diego Reader, and it's the field guide to the Natural History Museum's exhibition, Coast to Cactus, Southern California. But summarize, if you will, what readers will find in Coast to Cactus that they may not find elsewhere. How is it unique?
Well, first of all, it's more than a hiking guide. It is also a field guide. So unlike having to take your hiking guide out into an area that you want to explore along with many trail guides for flowers, for birds, for amphibians or reptiles, you can just take this one book, because what it does do is function as a field guide. There's 525 different species that are found in San Diego County that are featured, that have photos in them, that have full descriptions. So this is just the one book that you need to be able to study and learn about the county as you're hiking on a trail.
So that makes it much more practical.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's such a wonderfully colorful book.
Yeah, it has 665 color photos in it. It has 258 maps. It also features the habitats that you will find within the county. We're using the system that San Diego State University has on 9 different habitats that are found in San Diego County. And each of the maps has a symbol by it telling you what habitat you will encounter on that hike. So in some hikes, for instance, you may just have a chaparral or a riparian area. So there'll be the symbols for those two habitats next to the map, and you'll know you will encounter that on the hike. But another hike may have 5 or 6 different types of habitats that you will encounter as you are on the trail. So we're trying to teach people to become aware of when they hike, you know, what types of habitats they actually will encounter on those hikes.
That's wonderful. And can you also explain the map in the beginning of the book with the chapters for depending on which region?
We have a map in the front of the book, and we decided not to use a grid system that many hiking books do use. We wanted to make it easier for the readers so we have broken up the chapters according to logical areas that are geographical boundaries by freeways. So you can look at an area that's encompassed by, let's say, Interstate 15 or 5 and cross freeways that go, and you can go into that chapter and you will find all the hikes that are within that area. We have the overall breakdown of the book broken into the coastal hikes, the inland hikes, which are the foothills. We have the mountain hikes and the desert hikes. So those are the 4 regions that we cover within the book. And then within each of those regions, we break it down into geographical areas to make it easier for people to find those particular places that they want to explore.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So much to discover.
Yes.
Now, I understand that your company envisioned a hiking guide to the county, but then Jerry Schad's A Foot in a Field was published by Wilderness Press in 1986. How did that desire lead you to the production of Costa Cactus?
Well, my husband and I wrote the guidebook for the Anzabrego Desert region in 1978, and then we had thought beyond that, thinking that what was really needed was a guide to the entire county. Meanwhile, Jerry had been working on the county guide, and he came out with his book. It's a very excellent book. And so that kind of put our desires to do a county book on a shelf, but always we had that in the back of our minds. You know, if we were going to do a book, how could we do it that would be different than what Jerry did that people would be interested in? And at the time, you know, we wanted to learn more about the county and the things that we could see on the trail. And that's when we joined the San Diego Natural History Museum and became canyoneers almost 30 years ago. And to learn about the species and the plants and the habitats that are found on trails. And from that experience, the idea evolved that, well, what if we took this experiences of knowing the species and the habitats and actually integrated it within a guidebook, would that be something that people would be interested in? And would it actually lead to really learning about the county and helping to understand what is actually found in our county?
How long did it take to put this together? It sounds like an enormous project.
Well, we introduced I introduced the idea of working on a book such as this about a decade ago, and it seemed like an overwhelming project. So it kind of sat on a back shelf for many, many years. And actually what happened, Jerry unfortunately had passed away, and I was at his memorial service, and the publisher of the San Diego Reader, Jim Holman, had said that they were looking for somebody to take over the Roma Rama column, which Jerry had written very wonderful columns throughout the years.
Right.
So I went back to the Canyoneers and I said, you know, we have an opportunity here to actually do this book, and it would be more manageable because all we would have to do is do one article a week until we had enough articles to put it together in a book. And so that's when we made an agreement with my publishing house, the San Diego Natural History Museum, and the Canyoneers to work on this, and then we began the columns, a weekly column for the San Diego Reader. After several years, we had enough to do a book, and then the real work began. So then it was about 18 months, 2 years, to then basically strip all of the descriptions, pull it back, check all the descriptions for the trails to make sure they're accurate, and then to reinsert the descriptions, but not repeating them, only doing one particular detailed description in the book for every species that we wanted to cover. The difficulty here was to make sure that when we did put a species description in, that it was actually found on that trail and that the description was accurate. So we had to have all the curators with their specialties check everything we wrote. We had to work with all of the agencies where the trails were found and then run the trail descriptions by them to make sure they were accurate. They checked our trails. And so we made sure that not only were the species descriptions correct, that the habitats mm-hmm. that we said were there were correct, but that all of the information regarding those species were correct. And then, and so that was a long project. Yeah, we had two other editors besides myself that worked very closely together. So we made sure that all the descriptions were accurate, and then we went back and forth and double-checked everything.
It really sounds like a labor of love.
Well, actually, it was a labor of love because unlike most books where an author has the royalty and they make money from this book, everybody that worked on this book, all the canyoneers, and there's over 50 people who made contributions to the Roma Rama articles that we used, and the editors, myself and Paula Noel and Terry Barnell, all of us are volunteers at the San Diego Natural History Museum. So all our work was as a volunteer for the museum, and all the proceeds from the book that a normal author would receive are going to the museum. So when anybody buys Wonderful. This book, they're actually supporting the San Diego Natural History Museum.
That's nice to know. Talk a little bit more about the Canyoneers and this exhibit at the museum.
Yes, the Canyoneers are it's a program at the museum that's over 40 years old, and it was started by a botanist, Helen Shamley, at the museum. There was a canyon next to the museum, still there, mm-hmm. a Florida canyon, which was very lovely canyon. In several years later, after the Canyoneers began, it actually, there was a fire there, and that's what resulted in the Canyoneers actually moving out into the county. But the original idea was to have docents that were trained by the museum curators to take the public into the Florida Canyon. They were called the Florida Canyoneers, and to teach people what was in there and the value of that particular habitat. After the fire occurred, the habitat was not as pristine as it once was, so that's when the Canyoneers began to expand to do walks throughout the whole county, which we do now. We do offer free public walks every single weekend, and that is between September and June. You can find the free public walks by going onto the website for the San Diego Natural History Museum or picking up a brochure. No reservations required. Just show up. We break up into small groups, and the whole idea of a canyoneer walk is not to hurry up to get there and hurry up to get back. It's to walk slowly, to look around, to investigate, to smell, to see right. what the interaction is in the habitat with the surrounding plants and species.
So to engage all your senses.
Absolutely. And you asked about the connection to the exhibition, the Costa Cactus Southern California. That exhibition was created to basically get the county and the folks in the county to be aware of the habitats that are found here in the county. But more important than that, to understand that San Diego is a biological hot zone. It's a biodiversity hot zone. There are 32 places in the world that are hotspots, and to be a hotspot means that you have incredible diversity in an area, but you have threatened species or species that have disappeared. And because of that, you want to keep an eye and watch these areas very carefully. And because San Diego is a hotspot, we want people to be aware of what is out here. We want them to become more conscious of conservation for this area. And so that was part of what the exhibit is all about. So you can go to the exhibit, you can learn about the habitats, learn why San Diego is a hotspot, and then you can take the field guide, which is actually a complement to this exhibition, and this is your field guide to get into the field to actually see what's out there. So it complements the exhibition. One mm-hmm. is an actual museum experience, the other one is a field experience.
And do you think this will help conservation efforts?
We certainly hope so. It's, you know, the museum and also my publication house believe very strongly in what a Senegalese conservationist, Baba Douim, has said. And what he has said is, in the end, We will conserve only what we love. We will love only what we understand. And we will understand only what we are taught. And so that's what the exhibition is about. That's what this book is about. It's about teaching folks in San Diego County what is special about this county. And once you learn and get excited about it, you're going to have a personal feeling for it, and you're going to want to protect it and lead to taking care of these special areas, which as our county grows and more people move into it, we want to make sure these particular areas are protected.
Wonderful. I can't wait to dig into this book. One last question. What is your favorite trail?
Well, I'm known as a desert person, so obviously my favorite trails are all in the Anza-Borrego Desert State Park area. And those trails kind of vary for me depending on my moods. If I want a kind of a closed-in experience, I like to go into the slot canyons. Those are kind of fun because they're magical, especially with the light changes. If I want to have spectacular views, I might want to go up on Whale Peak and kind of take a look at the views around there. Split Mountain is always great for geology. Coyote Canyon is wonderful because it has the longest running stream in San Diego County. It always has water. Mountain Palm Canyon is wonderful. Mountain Palm Springs, rather. It has just wonderful palm trees that are in there. And then plus if you go up to Torote Bowl, there's the very rare elephant tree and the spectacular view of the Vallecito Badlands. So there's many special places in the Anza-Borrego Desert. Fonts Point, a lot of people like to go out there and take a look at that spectacular view, especially at sunset, as you look out over the Borrego Badlands. But it's a very special place. So for me, I'm happy almost anywhere in the desert.
And have you always been a desert person?
Well, not really. It's interesting that you should ask that because this happens to be my 50th anniversary of my introduction to Anza-Borrego State Park. I had actually met my husband at a mountaineering club at UCLA when we always went backpacking in the Sierras. And when he became a helicopter pilot with the Navy, we were stationed in San Diego, and he would fly over the desert on training missions and said, "Hey, we need to go out and check out that place." And I said, "Come on, get real. This is a desert. There's nothing there. That's right. Why it's a desert." And so we had a few arguments back and forth because he would say, "Come on, we really need to check it out." And I finally said, "Look, if I go one time out there, would you just quit bugging me?" So we went. I had a fantastic experience. It was spring. It was Painted Gorge out on Coyote Mountains. The following week, he said, "Okay, let's go to the Sierras." And I said, "Can we go back to the desert?" And I've been going ever since. My master's thesis was done on it, and several books have been done on the desert. And I always am anxious to get back to the desert.
Well, thank you for sharing your story.
You're welcome.
Our time is up, but it's been wonderful talking to you, Diana.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me.
For more information on Costa Cactus, please visit sunbeltpublications.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
If your home or business was flooded during the January 22nd storm, it's important to keep yourself and your family safe when you're cleaning up. Before trying to clean up after the storm, first, visit the recovery page at alertsandiego.org for safety tips, info on how to properly document your damages, and other resources. Be sure to take photos or videos of damage before you clean it up. Residents should only enter a flood-damaged building after local authorities have said it's safe to do so. Don't enter if there are floodwaters in or around the building or you smell gas. According to FEMA, you should follow these important tips when cleaning up after a flood. If you have been cleared to return to your home, wear clothing with long sleeves and long pants, work gloves, and heavy or rubber boots if you have them. FEMA also recommends wearing goggles and a mask. Do not wade in flood water, which could have dangerous debris in it. The water could also be contaminated or even electrically charged from a downed or underground power line. Use a flashlight instead of matches, lighters, or any other open flames for lighting, since gas may be trapped inside the building. Do not use electrical equipment if it's wet or if you're standing in water. If it is safe to do so, turn off your electricity to prevent electric shock. Throw away any food or drinks that may have come in contact with flood water. You should only drink clean, safe water. Wash your hands with soap and clean water, or use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer before eating. Dry out your home as soon as possible to prevent mold. If you suspect there is mold present, wear a respirator or an N95 mask when entering the building in addition to other protective gear. People with asthma, other respiratory conditions, or suppressed immune systems should not be around mold. To make a cleaner, mix a cup of household bleach with a gallon of water. Never mix bleach with ammonia. If you do attempt to clean the building yourself, open the doors and windows at least 30 minutes afterwards to air it out before staying for a length of time. Conduct an inventory of damages and contact your insurance company to see if you have coverage. You can also fill out the survey at the County of San Diego website to report your damages, since the county is tallying up damages in hopes of getting federal FEMA funds to assist victims of the catastrophic flooding. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
St. Mary's Ukrainian Orthodox Church in Spring Valley has been a place of worship for Ukrainians across San Diego since 1960. Since the Russian invasion of Ukraine began in 2022, the small church has welcomed and helped many Ukrainian refugees here and also gathered humanitarian relief supplies to send to war-torn Ukraine. But on Monday, January 22nd, a wall of storm water surged down Campo Road in Spring Valley's Casa de Oro community, inundating the Ukrainian church with 2 to 3 feet of mud and debris. 10 News reports the damage to the church is estimated at $200,000, with another $100,000 in damage or destruction of supplies that were meant to be shipped to Ukraine next week. None of these losses are covered by insurance. The sanctuary, church hall, parking lot, and the parish priest's residence are all drenched. Father Myron Mikhailyuk and his wife were trapped in knee-deep rushing waters for 45 minutes, clinging to a fence before they were rescued, according to the House of Ukraine's website. Volunteers have been working to start removing debris, rocks, and mud, a huge undertaking, but major repairs and new flooring are also needed. Plus, all donated goods for Ukraine must be unpacked, cleaned if possible, or replaced. A site for a new Ukrainian church was recently approved in Santee, but for now, the Spring Valley Parish remains the primary place of worship for Ukrainians in the San Diego region. The river of mud has been especially disheartening for displaced Ukrainian refugees and expats already distressed over the Russian invasion and the fate of loved ones in Ukraine. But Vera Scope, whose family members were founding members of this church, told 10 News, "Ukrainians are resilient. That spirit is truly amazing, and we'll get through it. You can help them get through it and recover by donating to a flood relief fund for the church set up by the House of Ukraine, which you can find on their website at houseofukraine.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia, and the Smashing Beats. Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.